James, and this is the Chats with James podcast. In this episode, I'm chatting with Sylvan Morris. This episode was recorded on the 28th of December, 2020. For more episodes and show notes, visit jamesmunns.com/podcast. New episodes are released every Tuesday. Enjoy! Special thanks to Louis Zong for the music. All right, so how's it going?
I'm all right, and you? I'm enjoying my 2 weeks of holiday right now in sunny Cape Town, South Africa. Which is really nice.
I know. I'm not sure if we've talked on Matrix or Twitter or anything, or if we reached out before. So do you want to give yourself a quick introduction to start off with?
Sure. I'm a 24-year-old South African. I work for a small startup here in Cape Town doing some embedded work. So I graduated from UCT, which is the University of Cape Town, mechatronics engineering, back in 2018, and been working for my the startup Plantify for the past 2 years. I saw your thing on Twitter and I thought I'd like to chat because I've actually been using some of the Rust stuff from that, from the Rust book at work. Unfortunately, not on our microcontroller, but as some tooling with regards to that. And so I thought that might be an interesting thing to chat about.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great place to start. I've definitely recommended that for a lot of teams before they dive in headfirst into switching everything over to Rust, is definitely get your feet wet with some tooling or some stuff that's off the critical path. So what kind of stuff are you using Rust as tooling for?
So yeah, actually a little bit of a story. Basically, about a year and a half ago, we realized we've got a little device and we need to install it in people's homes. And being the startup that we are, we need to do this fast and develop fast and realize that we're not going to have all the code ready for when we want to install the device. So the solution to that is OTA, for those that don't know, you know, like over-the-air firmware updates, which is a tough thing to do. So what we decided to do was we started with, we've got a microcontroller, the PIC32MM, and Microchip provides EZBL, which is a little like serial bootloader, which is great if you want to do, you know, UART bootloading. But if you've got a device which is sitting in someone's roof, it's a little bit harder to do. And so I reverse engineered their serial protocol and realized that I could probably get our devices in ESP8266 on board, which is connected via UART. And so if I can get that to act as this TCP UART bridge, I can get a server to act as a serial bootloader via TCP, via Wi-Fi. Mm. And so, yeah, long story short, I managed to reverse engineer the serial protocol. And then basically I had to come up with this server, and I've never done web dev ever before in my life. So I was like, oh, what do I do? Maybe I use Python, whatever. But Rust, I've been kind of looking at Rust, and then I realized the final chapter of the Rust book was a multi-threaded TCP server. And I was like, well, I need to design a TCP server, and I've never done it before. Maybe I should, you know, just do it the way they told me to. Of course, I have to read the whole book first. So I think Friday morning, I started reading the book. By Monday evening, I'd finished it. Monday evening, I started implementing the server. And then over the next few weeks, I worked on this kind of server that now, to this day, is one of the ways we update our devices. If we can connect it to Wi-Fi, we can do OTA via my little Rust TCP server, which is sitting on like a digital ocean instance somewhere. But yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, no, I was very chuffed, very, very chuffed. Yeah, being the small team that we are, like, I mean, I'm the only person writing tooling right now. I was writing tooling, so I kind of decided to do whatever I wanted, decided to go with Rust. Since then, we've decided that Python is the more accessible approach, and so I've been restricted in my Rust usage, but I did manage to get a little bit more done once we came up with our own OTA approach, which we're still working on. I was able to do kind of a serial version of that, which I again wrote in Rust, at least the PC side, which I love because it's all about serialization. You know, like if you're doing data flows, it's all about serialization. And Python's got the struct module, which credit where credit's due is very good. But I genuinely enjoyed designing structs in C and then in Rust, and then just having serialization work perfectly between the two using Serde. But yeah, so that's kind of what we've been up to, and I've just kind of been genuinely quite interested in the Rust thing. And unfortunately, we use a PIC32MM, which I think the last time it was supported by LLVM was 10 years ago. So, yeah.
I didn't even realize there was ever a PIC backend for that. Although PIC32 are close enough to the MIPS targets, isn't it?
It's micro.
Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, they're micro MIPS. So I have been on some chats on GitHub to see if maybe they can be done, but I haven't pushed it too far because the fact of the matter is we've got our whole, like, I've spent the last 2 years writing everything in C. So we're at the point where, like, it just doesn't make sense to to change it now.
Yeah.
But it is
save it for the next generation.
Exactly. But yeah, now I've gained a bit of a like reputation for any time we do something new that like Sylvan's gonna want to do it in Rust. So I have to hold back and say, no, it's fine. We can do it in Python or we can do it in C. But yeah, no, that's kind of what I'm gonna chat about, but it's just interesting story.
Yeah, it's always interesting. There's definitely an organizational cost. So wearing like my more manager hat instead of engineering hat, it's definitely important that the whole team knows and understands the tooling that you're using, because if you were to win the lottery tomorrow and leave and they have to maintain all of your code and they don't know anything about Rust, that's definitely a challenge, or it's a risk. And as a manager, you're always trying to reduce risk. So that's definitely one of the reasons why I suggest people start with tooling, because usually you can get people on board, and like, especially when you have things like CLI tools and things like that, where it's just like, oh, just download this binary or just cargo install this binary and you're good to go. That's usually a pretty good story, especially if people are coming from a background like Python or things like that, where packaging can be really challenging if you're using third-party packages and stuff like that, and setting up either a virtual environment or, you know, whatever you need for installation. Usually having like a single static binary to deploy is that usually you can cross compile to Windows, Mac, and Linux pretty easily is a pretty good use case. And then that's usually how you get people on board of like, oh yeah, there's that tool that just always works and I don't have to think about it. And then usually they're more interested once they've, you know, extended features and things like that. But getting kind of team buy-in is always a thing. It's one of the things that we do at Ferris a lot is trainings for those kind of teams where they have one or two Rust people on their teams. Now all of a sudden they need to get the other like 4, 5, 6, 10, 20 developers on their team up to speed with Rust so that they can all use the same tooling and things like that. So yeah, there's definitely that in-between point of, okay, we have something that works and we have one or two like people on the team who are really excited to use it, but how do we get it as a more widely used and understood tool in our team? And that can always be a bit of a challenge for different companies at different times.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think one of the biggest things is, as much as you want to be like, oh, Rust is great for this and this, and it allows you to do some fun things, and you know, you get to discover a bunch of stuff, there's always a deadline. You know, like you like to chat about, oh, it's all these cool things, but the fact of the matter is that in 2 weeks' time, we need a tool that does a certain thing, and if it takes someone 2 weeks to even get into Rust or whatever, then suddenly it's, you know, whatever your, you know, Python's better chance because it just, everyone knows it. And so, yeah, I found that was the big thing. It was like trying to convince my team to use it. It was like, cool, guys, give me a week to at least like help you figure out what is going on. And it's immediately the reaction is, okay, well, we could just spend a week writing our tool, you know, like it's good enough. We're not looking for like high speed performance. We're not looking for like async functionality. It's something that has to pump out some serial into a microcontroller, read out what's coming back. And the fact of the matter is like Python's been doing that for, you know, decades. So yeah, it is an interesting thing. Like it's always nice to have like all these great benefits, but unless you're really pushing the edge of stuff, it's quite difficult to, you know, push for it, especially when you have kind of people just pushing against it, you know, going, oh, but I know I can do this in my own thing. I can, you know, just let me do this, you know. Yeah. But that's kind of the approach we've taken.
Yeah, the best tools are always the ones you know how to use. You know what I mean? And especially if you don't have a group that's interested or has like a specific use case where they say, oh yeah, in this case, Rust would really help us. It's always a challenge to start that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that was kind of the interesting thing, is that being able to take the book and kind of pump something out that actually works. I mean, it's something we use to this day. It's been working for over a year now. Of like where we've been doing OT updates via this. I mean, it's not perfect. It's like bugs, which it's like kind of like Sylvan did this thing, and I'd be like, no, it's fine, you know, give it 15 minutes and it'll sort itself out. But being able to basically like hack, and for me it was my first big kind of tooling project. I'd done a lot of embedded stuff to that point, but where I was able to kind of get something that I put into my friend's house anywhere, I mean literally anywhere in the world, and suddenly I'm able to just put new code on there and, you know, reset it. And within 15 minutes, or I think it took like 8 minutes, you can have new code being run, and which is just great. It really helped us improve stuff and specifically help us catch things, because I mean, we're in the testing phase. We've got like dog food and friends and family and all those kind of, you know, but now that we've kind of come up with our own solution, it's quite nice to have like this backstop still, because, you know, things can go wrong. But yeah.
Yeah. Actually writing a bootloader is one of my next things, because I've got a couple sensors deployed in my house and it's not so bad to go and reflash them, but I'm at the point where I'm going, All right, I should probably just write a bootloader, shouldn't I? So I don't have to like walk over and bring a debugger and plug it into debugger into the connectors, you know. So I have a feeling probably writing at least a really basic bootloader so that I can do over the air updates, since they're wireless sensor devices. Probably going to end up writing a bootloader in Rust. There's been a couple other people who have written bootloaders already. So I either need to go like find one that I like and adapt it for what I'm using it for, or just write my own that's terrible and, you know, does the basic amount of work that I need. But yeah, it's one of those things where it really changes how you develop software, being able to have a bootloader and it's like an over-the-air update capability, just because it changes it from having to deploy and hope that you got everything right, or even just like the tedium of having to like sit there and attach a debugger to all of the devices. And especially as I start getting towards, like right now I have like two or three devices on the wireless sensor network. And once I start having like six or seven or eight, if I want to start pushing firmware updates, I don't want to like spend an hour walking around all the devices, which might be battery powered on my home. But yeah, so I think probably a bootloader is one of the next challenges that I'm going to have for my wireless devices, just because it's so much better to have a bootloader and over the air update capabilities.
Yeah, no, it is great. I don't know if you know Balena. I mean, you should know Balena with their kind of Raspberry Pi stuff. But I've been looking into kind of what they've been doing with their whole, you know, fleet approach, because this is their thing. You know, it's embedded fleet management. You know, they've got OTAs, they've got logging, they've got tracing, all that kind of stuff. That for me has been really interesting to see how far they've taken it. I mean, you're running Linux. You're not going to be running on like a PIC32 or an STM32, but the amount of tooling that really pushed onto these devices is quite amazing. I was playing around with a friend's project. I was trying to set up some like audio stuff for her, and just looking at their I don't know if you've seen any of their like example projects. But one of them is effectively like a Sonos replica where you can have, you know, Spotify connect. And funny enough, I was watching the logging and it panicked at one point, the Spotify service running, and it's Rust. their Spotify service is Rust. Yeah. I was like, oh, look, that. I mean, it broke, so not great, but I can see that it's panicked and it's Rust.
Nice.
But yeah, for me, that genuinely is one of the most interesting parts of embedded development, is how you've got this kind of software development techniques creeping into the realm of it. Because, I mean, for years, you had to run Windows, because no one produced any of their tools for Linux. And now it's slowly getting there. Like I have recently, I don't know if you know Seedling, the unit test framework. So I recently set up Seedling with CircleCI, with the plan being that I can then mock our embedded system and run it, you know, have it on pushes. And that for me is just like amazing, because I mean, you can get to the point where we'll have commits pushed and then eventually just OTA straight onto a dog food device and then run tests. It's just like mind blowing that you can do that with a device that's got 32 kilobytes of RAM.
That's why I'm writing this Embedded the Missing Parts book, because there's so many software development techniques that totally apply to embedded systems development, but it seems like embedded systems development has been in this weird self-enforced dark age for a really long time like you said, like tooling that's not automatable or not scriptable because it only has a Windows client, it requires a license dongle, and how do you put that on your CI server? And I've done that, you know, over the last 10 years for a couple companies, of where I have provisioned like an IAR license on our CI machine so that we could compile and run and either run unit tests on device or off device or things like that. But there's a huge amount of this that is very challenging. So you mentioned Balena in the more bare metal embedded. I've talked to a couple of the folks at Memfault. I'm not sure if you've read like the interrupt blog or anything like that. But,
yeah. No, it's great stuff. It's great.
Before they started Memfault, I sat down with them, and that's where I wrote the table of contents. So the Memfault folks are a couple of ex-Pebble and a couple of ex-other embedded development company engineers. And we kind of sat down, and it's one of those things where it's really amazing where if you've worked at a company where people had their embedded software development practice together, they've been doing all of these things for 10 or 15 years already. Like the concept of CI or CD or logging or tracing or tracebacks and things like that is not super new, but it's just not widespread in the embedded industry. And it really seems to come down to, have you worked at a company where you've seen that this is possible and know that this has been possible for a really long time? So I've used Seedling, like you mentioned, for unit testing for customers and things like that. And before that, I was using a framework called CMaka, which is based, it's a fork of the old C-based Google test framework and things like that. But yeah, it's definitely been possible for a while, but it's really amazing to me that there are so many embedded developers who don't know that this is a possibility. And yeah, that embedded missing parts book is aiming to be exactly that, of just like, if nothing else, introducing you to these concepts so that you can have a conversation about it, or you can read about how this relates to embedded systems. So, you know, like, you can go read blog posts about continuous integration or continuous delivery in non-embedded context to get some of these ideas of how they can work, and then at least have some layer of translation of, okay, but how does this help me as an embedded developer with, like you said, of having staggered rollouts, for example. So maybe your first set of users or your cohort of users is your friends and family. And then maybe you have something like a 10% of beta users will get this firmware image, and you see if anything breaks in practice. Or then you roll it out to all of your beta users, and then you do like 10% of your production users, and then roll it out, you know. And I know Memfault has some tooling for capturing logs and doing these kind of cohort-based rollouts and things like that as services that they provide. But and I've seen a couple of other providers in the embedded space do this as well, that are targeting more of the bare metal applications rather than embedded Linux like Balena is. But it's really interesting to see in some industries how pervasive this is, and in some industries how totally not pervasive this is.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting. Like, I studied at UCT, and I did a mechatronics degree, which there is firmware I've taught there. You like get taught assembly, you get taught C. But I mean, testing is never mentioned. It's, you know, like, it's debugging is probably the most important thing you could be taught at university, especially for an electrical engineer. And it's glossed over, you know, like, you spend more time focusing on Fermi levels in material science than you do on debugging. You kind of go like, let's maybe focus on things that are slightly more relevant to your day to day. And so my exposure to continuous integration, continuous development, deployment, and unit testing is basically been my interest in, you know, just general software engineering. I'm not a software engineer. I did not study software engineering, but I've gone and, you know, I read various blog posts and various things just to kind of learn more about it. And then you kind of realize that actually embedded development, it's software. Like, I mean, we like to call it firmware. We like to say we're special. We like to say that, oh, we use a debugger and, you know, whatever. The fact of the matter is it's code. And yes, there are special cases where, you know, you need to run a motor or whatever, and that you can't like do on a computer. But the fact of the matter is that the rest of it can. It can all be done on a computer. And that means that it can all be done through, you know, various software development things. And people have been doing this for years, as you said. Like, it's just for some reason takes someone to go, hey, maybe there's a better way to do this, and look at it and go, oh, there is. And people have been doing this for, you know, decades. So I totally agree with you that this kind of like this knowledge isn't being implanted, I think, at the earlier levels, like, you know, the universities. Or, I mean, given my perspective, when I came to the company, we didn't have any firmware. Like, there was zero. The first stuff I did was I wrote the hardware abstraction layer. I was running, basically reading the data sheet and just writing functions. So I was never going to get exposed to this. It was simply me kind of, oh, maybe there's somewhere to do this. Hey, like, maybe we can do unit tests. Hey, maybe we can do this. And it's the real difficult part is you want to do all these good things because you know there's a good like result at the end. The hurdles are the problems, because you're not only fighting the hurdle of, hey, how do you get a unit test framework to run on CircleCI? You're also going, oh, also I need to make sure our temperature sensors work for the products about to be released next week. You know, which one's slightly more important? And so that I think is one of the difficult things, is if you're in a community that doesn't value these things, doesn't value these software techniques, you're not going to be incentivized to do them, because you're expected to just pump out code or expected to do whatever. And unless the knowledge is there, and it's believed, it's this is the best way to do this thing. This is why it takes so much time. Unless that's already there, it's very tough to go, actually, this is the better way to do it, because the present key is like, oh, well, we get software out as fast as we can, and this is just going to slow us down. Because obviously the time it saves isn't the known time. It's the unknown time. It's the debugging. It's the tracing. It's the, you know, figuring all that. That's all like, it's unknown time. So it's very hard to go, yeah, are we saving it? Because there's no way to really quantify that.
Yeah. One of the things that I, you know, like you said, it's always a challenge. Part of my job is consulting, and very, very often I run into these same things at different levels, whether you're talking about different techniques or different approaches and things like that. And getting buy-in on using certain techniques and using certain approaches can be a challenge sometimes if you've got a resistive audience, if that makes sense. And one of the most effective ways I found of talking about this that really matches, especially if you have managers with a lot of management experience or at least a little bit of embedded, or engineering experience, is to talk about risk, because that's generally why we do these things like testing, is that we're reducing risk. And especially when you have, in a startup environment, you only get one chance to get it right. Usually when you have these tight deadlines, there's no time, like you said, to spend extra time debugging and things like that. So usually the question is not, do I do testing or not? Generally phrasing the conversation around the concept of, hey, look, we only have one chance to get this right, and we need it to be delivered on a predictable amount of time. And the way that you do that is you clear all of the low-hanging fruit so that you don't end up getting bit by these things. So definitely speaking in terms of risk is usually something that managers I found really relate with, where you say, okay, yeah, it's going to take maybe one day extra, maybe sometimes it even takes less, because like you said, it takes less time debugging, but you say, okay, it can take one day extra and the level of risk is much lower, or it could take one day faster, but 50-50 shot, it will take three times as long because I have to go troubleshoot things and do things like this. And especially once they start seeing those in practice where they can see the before and after and have proof points of that, of like, hey, yeah, it really did, you know, since we started doing these techniques, we've been much more predictable, or we're able to schedule this. And that's one of those things that I find managers really appreciate, is you talk to them on the order of risk, because there's one of the things, I can't remember who said it, but estimates without associated risk are worthless. Because if you just say, oh, it's going to take 1 week, that's not actually a very useful estimate. But once you start saying, okay, I'm 50% confident I can deliver this in a week, and I'm 99% confident I can deliver it in 3 weeks. And once you start talking on that level, and once you start saying, well, once I start adding unit testing and things like that, it becomes, I'm 50% confident I can deliver this in 1 week, and I'm 99% confident I can deliver this in 1.5 weeks. Then they start understanding the difference of that. Oh, what they're providing with that is they're tightening that bound. So definitely one of the things that I have a whole thing that I do when I do consulting, of just coaching engineers to speak more effectively with managers. Because a lot of the times when I get brought in to do consulting, it's just a breakdown of communication, where you have very good managers and you have very good engineers, but they're just not communicating effectively. And so they're feeling that mismatch of, they think that they're saying something, but the other side, you know, they're transmitting some idea, but the other side's not receiving it effectively. And that's not necessarily because someone's obstructive or unintelligent or something like that. There's just this impedance mismatch of speaking between a management domain and the concerns you worry about as a manager, and the engineering domain and the concerns you worry about it as an engineer. So a lot of the times it's a little bit of communications coaching for managers and for engineers as a consultant to make sure people are like understanding the trade-offs that each other are working on and trusting each other to manage those trade-offs. So definitely for engineers, one of the things that I recommend to them is think about risk. Think about what could go wrong, especially if you're doing something like talking about Rust, of, you know, what are the potential rewards and what are the potential risks? And being able to quantify that as an engineer, you'll have a much better time communicating to managers and getting buy-in on certain decisions or technology decisions, because they can make a more informed choice, because they may not understand what Rust is and what it delivers. And you've played around with it and you've used it and you understand it, and that's great. But part of your job as an engineer is also to get that understanding over to them, because that's your job, is to kind of pass that, speaking nebulous on the you as an engineer.
Yeah, I get what you mean. I really like the way that you phrase that as risk. We try to do something that, like, we talk about certainty, and I think in some ways that's an inverse, but risk is definitely a better way to put it. And yeah, I do appreciate the idea of that, you know, an extra day reduces risk by arguably and like a non-linear amount. So yeah. you know, sometimes taking that extra day can, you know, save you. But yeah, risk is probably a better way to put it. I do appreciate that comment. Thank you.
Yeah, and definitely with startups, that's the thing that I found is the answer is always it needs to be done as quick. Like, I've spent a couple of years, especially in IoT startups and things like that. And when, especially when they're like, oh, we want custom hardware and custom software in 2 weeks, go. And you're like, excuse me. Like, and it's one of those things where you realize that, like, and I've delivered on projects like those. Those are super stressful, but you go, okay, if I only, like, I've agreed to deadlines like that. And I'm like, okay, 2 weeks is basically like the minimum amount of time. And if anything goes wrong, we're done. Like, we're cooked. So like, there's definitely chances where I go, okay, we only have time for one hardware spin, so we better get it right. And then, like, we only have time to deploy software once, so we better get it right. And those kind of things of, you know, when you only have one chance, sometimes doing the extra due diligence makes all the difference, because you only are going to get one shot. You don't have enough time in the budget to try again, where usually, especially when I'm talking about estimates and things like that, the difference between a hard deadline of 1 or 2 weeks and a hard deadline of 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks can be a huge amount of difference in terms of what we, you know, cost it out, because there's no room for second chances. Where if you have room to, like, you know, try and fail and try and fail and do iterative approaches, that's great. But when you only have room to get it right once, then that's, you know, it's go big or go home kind of time.
No, I get exactly what you mean. Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's all those two week projects. I luckily haven't had a 2 week project yet, and I hopefully never have to have one of those. But it is honestly that it's not that the project can't be done. It's just, you know, like, how full of a project you want. You know, there's a bare metals approach, the bare metal approach, which will solve this. But, you know, that means we're buying a Raspberry Pi instead of rolling our own. You know, it's those type of trade offs. And also, how much of an engineer do you want left after that? Are you expecting? Are you coming on for 3 months and cheers, goodbye? You know, go sleep for the rest of the year, or do you expect us to continue working for you for the foreseeable future? Because one of those is kind of, you know.
That's one of those things that startups often have a challenge with, of like setting a reasonable pace of delivery and integration and stuff like that, because it can be, like you said, really challenging to deliver at those at a consistent basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to have a realistic view. It's not necessarily that, you know, every engineer must only work 6 hours a day and make sure that then they'll be all right. It's like crunch. There's definitely time for crunch, and there's definitely time to put it down. But it's all about budget. You're using up time now, which needs to be replaced sometime else. And like, as long as that's within the full view, I think it can be done well. And luckily, where I'm at right now, they've had a very good view of, if we burn people out, there's only one person who can do that job. So if they're burnt out, no one's doing that job. So let's make sure that they're still around, which has been greatly appreciated from my side. But yeah, I definitely get that point of kind of like, it's all about compromise. It's budgeting and compromise. And there's never really like a smooth answer of, oh no, we don't force our engineers to do this, or all our engineers do 12-hour days, because yeah.
I don't think I would last at a company very long that expected 12-hour days ever.
Yeah. Me neither.
Okay, great. Yeah. Well, it's been excellent to have a quick chat with you. Before we wrap up, is there any cool projects you're working on, or anything else that, or a Twitter account or anything like that, that you'd like to plug, or you definitely want people to go look at after they hear this conversation?
No. I've got nothing I need to show. Just that you came for the chat and it was a good conversation. So thank you.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for reaching out, and definitely let's have another chat again sometime soon.
Sounds good.
All right.
Cheers.
Enjoy the rest of the day.
Bye.
Bye.
You too.